welcome to Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming on the web at kpfk.org. My name is Damon Azali, and I'm here with my co-host Eric Mann. Today, we're very lucky to dedicate the whole show to the life of Malcolm X, and we'll be talking to Dr. Manning Marable, who is currently working on a comprehensive biography on Malcolm X entitled Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, set to be published by Viking in 2009. Dr. Manning Marable, are you on the line with us?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Welcome to the show. So we wanted to start out with hearing Malcolm in his own words, so we're going to do an excerpt from his message to the grassroots speech delivered in 1963 in November, and then we'll be right back with you, and it runs about 8 minutes, so we'll be right back. Here we go.
There was two kinds of slaves. There was the house Negro and the field Negro. The house Negro, they lived in the house with master. They dressed pretty good. They ate good because they ate his food. But he left. They lived in the attic or the basement, but still they lived near their master. And they loved their master more than the master loved himself. They would give their life to save their master's house quicker than the master would. The house Negro, if the master said, "We got a good house here," the house Negro said, "Yeah, we got a good house here." Whenever the master said "we," he said "we." That's how you can tell a house Negro. If the master's house caught on fire, the house Negro would fight harder to put the blaze out than the master would. If the master got sick, the house Negro would say, "What's the matter, boss? We sick? We sick?" He identified himself with his master more than his master identified with himself. And if you came to the house Negro and said, "Let's run away, let's escape, let's separate," that house Negro would look at you and say, "Man, you crazy. What you mean separate? Where is there a better house than this? Where can I wear better clothes than this? Where can I eat better food than this?" That was that house Negro. In those days, he was called a house nigger. And that's what we call him today, because we still got some house niggers running around here. This modern house Negro loves his master. He wants to live near him. He'll pay three times as much as the house is worth just to live near his master. And then brag about, "I'm the only Negro out here." "I'm the only one on my job. I'm the only one in this school. You're nothing but a house Negro." And if someone come to you right now and say, "Let's separate," you say the same thing that the house Negro said on the plantation. "What you mean, separate? From America? This good white man? Where you gonna get a better job than you get here? I mean, this is what you say. I ain't left nothing in Africa." That's what you say. "Why, you left your mind in Africa." On that same plantation, there was the field Negro. The field Negro, those were the masses. There was always more Negroes in the field than there was Negroes in the house. The Negro in the field caught hell. He ate leftovers. In the house, they ate high up on the hog. The Negro in the field didn't get nothing but what was left of the insides of the hog. They call them chitlins nowadays. In those days, they call them what they were, guts. That's what you were, a gut eater. And some of you are still gut eaters. The field Negro was beaten from morning till night. He lived in a shack, in a hut. He wore cast-off clothes. And he hated his master. I say he hated his master. He was intelligent. That house Negro loved his master. But that field Negro, remember, they were in the majority. And they hated the master. When the house caught on fire, he didn't try and put it out. That field Negro prayed for a wind, for a breeze. When the master got sick, the field Negro prayed that he died. If someone comes to the field Negro and says, let's separate, let's run, he didn't say, where are we going? He said, any place is better than here. You got field Negroes in America today. I'm a field Negro. The masters are the field Negroes. When they see this man's house on fire, you don't hear these little Negroes talking about our government is in trouble. They say the government is in trouble. Imagine a Negro. Our government. I even heard one say, our astronauts. They won't even let him near the plant. And our astronauts. Our Navy. That's a Negro that's out of his mind. That's a Negro that's out of his mind. Just as the slave master in that day used Tom, the house Negro, to keep the field Negroes in check, the same old slave master today has Negroes who are nothing but modern Uncle Toms, 20th century Uncle Toms, to keep you and me in check, keep us under control, keep us passive and peaceful and nonviolent. That's Tom making you nonviolent. It's like when you go to the dentist and the man is going to take your tooth. You're going to fight him when he starts pulling. So they squirt some stuff in your jaw called Novocaine to make you think they're not doing anything to you. So you sit there, and of course you got all that Novocaine in your jaw, you suffer peacefully. There's nothing in our book, the Quran, as you call it, Quran, teaches us to suffer peacefully. Our religion teaches us to be intelligent. Be peaceful. Be courteous. Obey the law. Respect everyone. But if someone puts his hand on you, send him to the cemetery. That's a good religion. In fact, that's that old-time religion. That's the one that Ma and Pa used to talk about. An eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth, and a head for a head, and a life for a life. That's a good religion. And then anybody, no one, resents that kind of religion being taught but a wolf who intends to make you his meal. This is the way it is with the white man in America. He's a wolf, and you a sheep. Anytime a shepherd, a pastor, teach you and me not to run from the white man, and at the same time teachers don't fight the white man, he's a traitor to you and me. Don't lay down our life all by itself. No. Preserve your life. It's the best thing you got. And if you got to give it up, let it be even Stephen.
Hey, Manning, how you doing? This is Eric
Doing
Mann.
Fine, Eric. It's good to hear you.
Nice to hear you. A lot of the listeners know Manning Marable. Dr. Manning Marable is a professor of public affairs, political science, history, and African-American studies at Columbia University in New York. He's written several important articles and books. He's written tons of important articles and books. Donates much of his time fundraising and speaking on behalf of prisoners' rights groups. And, of course, he's working on this long-awaited intervention and reinterpretation of Malcolm's life. Listening, Manning, to I've listened to this message to the grassroots like, I don't know, 100 times.
Right.
And every time I'm just struck by the brilliance, the probably greatest orator we've experienced in our lifetime, the choice of words, the sense of humor, the biting wit, the working with his audience and yet pushing his audience to the left at the same time. One of the ways to start, I'd like to ask you, is that obviously at the time I was fortunate enough to see him when he was alive and fortunate enough to have been at his funeral in Harlem and heard Ossie Davis's great, Our Black Prince speech.
Right.
Where is today the concept of separation as for black people as an independent point of view? Where in New Orleans, like I'm working on a book on New Orleans I'll tell you about later, but in looking at people in New Orleans, one of the questions I'm asking sort of is where is Malcolm today as a political voice? It seems like much of his contribution is more generalized, appreciated, but his actual politics seem to be lost.
Well, we have to ask the question, I suppose, first, which politics of Malcolm in what period of his development, because there's an evolution in his thought that accelerates in the last year and a half of his life. Although what I've been finding in my research is surprisingly a greater continuity of his thought than most scholars and most writers have previously appreciated, that there's a profound anti-imperialist and internationalist perspective that's embedded in his critique of European and U.S. global power that is apparent as early as the late 50s. But to answer your question, really, your question really focuses on where things are today. And it's difficult to answer that with Malcolm as the touchstone, because we have to ask the question, well then, which Malcolm are we talking about? Are we talking about the Malcolm who was the national representative of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad during the early 1960s? Or are we talking about Malcolm in the last weeks of his life saying, being interviewed in Canada on television, in Montreal, he said, all of my life I thought that the fundamental divide was black versus white. Now I realize that it's the haves versus the have-nots. Or giving a speech only 3 days before his assassination at the Barnard College gym at Columbia University that is on the theme, there is a world revolution going on. So there is an evolution in his thought, and the great danger is in freezing or reifying Malcolm without recognizing the dialectical evolution of his thought, very much the way that people freeze Martin Luther King Jr. on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial giving his I Have a Dream speech, but usurping and destroying the last 2.5 years of his life, where he moves toward an internationalist, anti-imperialist perspective, where he calls for a much more profoundly class analysis of the dynamics of inequality in the United States. And so the liberals want to jettison that part of King. Those who supposedly defend Malcolm sometimes want to jettison parts of Malcolm, whether it's the last year of his life, for those who favor a more nationalist approach to Malcolm, or whether it's those who are on the left who want to jettison everything he did in the Nation of Islam. I think that as a historian, I'm obligated to tell the whole truth about the whole person. and his entire evolution. And that can only be done through a dialectical analysis. So perhaps that's a fancy way of not answering your question.
We'll come back
to that. Yeah, well, I say we'll get back to that. So I think that is a good segue into something that you wrote in an article that was published in 2002 in Crisis, mm-hmm. in which you spoke about how, since there was kind of a lack of archival and documentation of Malcolm X's life, a lot of what we know about Malcolm X is through Alex Haley's autobiography or Spike Lee's Malcolm X, the movie.
Right.
And so I think that's where I kind of want to take this, is for you to kind of talk about those two, but then also, as a third, include yourself. Because I think a lot of it is based on the lenses that each of the writers, documentators use in terms of viewing his life. So let's start off with Alex Haley.
Right.
What was his kind of his politics and his aims in writing the book on Malcolm X? And actually, another question on that, was he actually able to read the book, or did he die before it was actually published?
The quick answer to the second question is that Malcolm was able to see the galleys. Theoretically, he was able to see galleys. But you have to remember that Doubleday, which was the original publisher of the autobiography of Malcolm X, pulled the contract less than two and a half weeks after Malcolm's assassination. They pulled they made the biggest mistake in publishing history, corporate publishing history, by destroying the contract and urging Haley to sign with somebody else, because Malcolm was so radioactively hot politically, they didn't want to touch it. And so Haley signed with Grove. So the reality is that Malcolm never really saw the galleys or the page proofs of his own book.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, Haley created a book that is really three books. The three books of Malcolm, of the autobiography, are the first roughly, about 17 or 18 chapters where Malcolm lays out what his original purpose in writing the book was: to re-ingratiate himself into the Nation of Islam. He was on the outs. The coterie of the leadership around Elijah Muhammad in Chicago opposed Malcolm's progressive line and also the cult of personality around him. And they wanted to either force him out or to eliminate him or reduce his authority within the Nation of Islam, the NOI. And so Malcolm agreed to write the book to show this kind of confessional, to show the power, the transformative power of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in uplifting his own life as a testimony to the greatness of Elijah Muhammad. Well, of course, by late 63, with Malcolm's silencing and then his expulsion, in effect, or his departure, the purpose of the book then shifts. And so there's a second book that Malcolm and Haley collaborate on. Remember, there are two authors of this book, not just one. And Haley is a constant filter, interpreting and framing the voice of Malcolm. Sometimes he does it very accurately, sometimes not. In the second book, you get basically Malcolm talking about the miracle of Mecca coming back. And then he says things at the end of the book that seem very odd for anybody familiar with the Message to the Grassroots speech, that actually don't sound like Malcolm very much at all, but are in this book, you know. Like, you know, at the end, like, Malcolm is saying, I love Republicans, I love conservatives, I even love Uncle Tom's, you know. So one wonders, you know, like we used to say, is it Live or Memorex? Is this Malcolm or is it Haley, right? And then finally, you get the kind of liberal integrationist book, which is the 11 pages by Alfred Balk, who's the New York Times journalist, that Haley tacks on at the beginning to introduce Malcolm and frame him within the context of the civil rights movement. And then Haley, who was supposed to only write an afterword that was only a few pages, writes a tacks on 79 pages of his own ruminations over the meaning of Malcolm, just so the readers understand that for Haley, Malcolm is a cautionary tale of the tragedy of the dead-end intellectual, the dead-end life of the ghetto, and the power, the transformative power of integration in uplifting Malcolm to be much greater than he once was. Haley was a Republican. He was a dyed-in-the-wool integrationist. He was antithetical to everything Malcolm stood for politically, and he really didn't understand black nationalism, and he had no sympathy whatsoever for Pan-Africanism. However, he understood the power of a charismatic figure and the power of a good story, and that's why he signed on to the project. When Haley first began writing for the Nation of Islam, one of the things that most people don't know that I talk about in my recent book, Living Black History, is that in 1962, when Haley wrote a piece for early 63 when it was published in the Saturday Evening Post, he wrote a piece that was entitled The Black Merchants of Hate. He collaborated with the FBI, taking information from the Bureau to frame and write a negative piece on the Nation of Islam. So this is a man who was already collaborating with the FBI, who was vetting, as he was writing this book with Malcolm, information to a corporate attorney who was working with Doubleday that Malcolm had no knowledge of, and also trying to frame the words to get by certain passages that Malcolm might not notice. So it is a very complex history here.
And obviously, you're saying, Manny, though, still, but he saw the galleys. The actual book was not published until after he died.
So absolutely.
So that the afterward, a 79-page afterward, he did not sign on to.
That's right.
And, you know, if he was a work in progress. So that's very important. So you certainly, let's just stay there because we're going to move to now Spike Lee's film. So you would say that there's some actual misrepresentation of, that this is not Malcolm in progress, this is, I'll put words, you know, Haley taking advantage of Malcolm's death to re-spin
right.
a lot of Malcolm in a way to sell 3 million books and
exactly.
Okay.
To take advantage of, you know, Malcolm's death permitted Haley or allowed Haley to spin the story in a particular kind of way that it's highly unlikely than Malcolm would have endorsed.
Right.
Now
let's move quickly to
sure.
Spike Lee. Is that okay? We have
sure.
a lot. We're happy to have you. Wish we had a 5-hour show. So
that's all right.
So the next thing, let's move to Spike Lee. Amiri Baraka warned Spike Lee not to make the film and said essentially, you are not of the political depth, political allegiance, you know, This is a black treasure, and you have the access. But once you do the film, this will have a certain definitive nature to it, which will be distorted. And then subsequently, in the Amiri Baraka Reader, Baraka says that, in now critiquing the film that he warned against, he wasn't the only one, that a major omission in the story, of course, is that both Malcolm's parents were very influenced by Garvey.
Right.
And that Malcolm's life did not start on the streets of Chicago, I believe it was, or Detroit, where the film starts, which is, as I remember it, right, which is two street guys, Denzel and Spike himself,
right.
but starts with Garveyite parents. I believe that his father was killed by a white mob. And that his mother had severe psychological problems because of racism.
Right.
So if we had started the story even there, but the point is the essence of it, and I'm not trying to make the critique as open the conversation, is what do you think of the film And do you think it, as a historian, moves the understanding of Malcolm X forward, or do you think, like the autobiography in parts, sets it back?
I think that it's a case of two steps forward and one step back here. That is, that I tend to be more positive about the film than my good comrade and friend Amiri. The film brought to life Malcolm to a new generation of activists who, for whom the 1960s and 70, early 70s were not even memories. They were born at that time. And so for the hip-hop generation, other than clips that they saw in videos of Public Enemy, they really didn't have a substantive clue about Malcolm. And the film presented a three-hour kind of documentary that gave them a sense of who Malcolm was and what the buzz was about. On the downside, the first hour of this three-hour film is devoted to Malcolm during his Detroit Red phase, which is really terrible because, in effect, it makes it kind of like a Hollywood musical, dancing scenes and, you know, high drama, criminality, and all of that. But what I'm finding is if you actually look at his Malcolm's real criminal record, this is not Bugsy Siegel or, you know, Dutch Schultz.
Right.
You know, Malcolm was a petty criminal, but his actual criminal record was barely 13 months. First time he's arrested is in the fall of 1944, and he goes to prison in January 1946, and he gets 10 years only because he's caught with several white women who are part of his crew. That's it. Otherwise, he probably would have only been sentenced to prison for a year. So this is not a hardened criminal. He's only 21 years old.
We're speaking with Professor Manning Marable about Malcolm X. We'll be back after a short break to continue the conversation, and we'll continue talking about the film for a little bit, Manning. Thanks for having you. We'll keep going.
All right.
Speaking as a black man from America, which is a racist society, no matter how much you hear it talk about democracy, it's as racist as South Africa or as racist as Portugal or as racist as any other racialist society on this earth. The only difference between it and South Africa preaches separation and practices separation. America preaches integration and practices segregation. This is the only difference. They don't practice what they preach. Whereas South Africa preaches and practices the same thing. I have more respect for a man who lets me know where he stands, even if he's wrong, than one who comes up like an angel and is nothing but a devil.
So we are back with Voices from the Frontlines on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. We're on the phone with Dr. Manning Marable talking about Malcolm X. And I actually think that this clip that we just heard is kind of an illustration of what you were just talking about in terms of the Spike Lee's movie. If we look at this clip, this was a clip that is on an Ice Cube album. So Ice Cube, who...
Right.
Back in the day, you know, was the gangster rap N.W.A. that moved to the Nation of Islam phase and then now is a director and does Barbershop and whatnot. And it finds it interesting on the whole other thing around the album is stuff about shooting and killing. And then he puts this whole 2-minute thing with excerpts from Malcolm X's speeches in
right.
it. And I think the one thing that for me, and actually the movie was my first real sense of who Malcolm X was, and I think it had an effect to say, oh, man, I want to learn more about this. I think as I developed politically, though, I saw where there was lacking in the kind of politics of it. And I think that is where his kind of collected speeches, as the third example that you right. mentioned in your article, that's in his words, in his voice, that helped fill out the complexity of what he was actually saying and make it more than a
right.
than a music video.
But here's the problem with the speeches. Well, let me tie up the movie.
Okay.
The other piece that's dreadfully problematic with the film is that in the last year of his life, they glossed over Malcolm's anti-imperialism, his
right.
opposition to the Vietnam War, his growing class analysis, and especially his growing gender awareness, especially about leadership of women in black political organizations. There's a real struggle, and when in the next couple of years, when our listeners will get a chance to see this book I've been working on, that one of the contentious issues inside of the Organization of Afro-American Unity that Malcolm formed in May, June of 1964 was that a lot of the brothers who came with him to found the OAAU, who had been members of the NOI, the Nation of Islam, they didn't understand why Malcolm went out of his way to recruit and to elevate and advance of talented African-American women in political leadership in the OAAU. And they were very upset about it. And a number of them left the organization around the gender question, right? So that Malcolm, as he traveled in Africa and in North Africa and saw successful socialist revolutions or revolutionary movements, he studied and reflected on the fact that those nations and those movements that were more egalitarian on gender questions seemed to be more advanced around all other kinds of questions. And so he began to adapt that to his own organization. And there were real tensions within his group around that question. So Malcolm's evolution was very profound in the last year. And Spike Lee basically gives that all short shrift. And finally, what he's really derelict about is he does this laughable take on the FBI and the CIA and their surveillance of Malcolm. But it was deadly. That Malcolm's organization was riddled with informants and cops, that we know about Gene Roberts, who was in his security entourage on the day of his death, who was NYPD boss, Bureau of Special Services and Investigation, who gives Malcolm mouth-to-mouth resuscitation in the Audubon when after Malcolm is shot. He's a cop. We know that other people, I know that the FBI had at least six operatives, two of whom in this book I will name, who were there that day at the Audubon when Malcolm was shot. So, you know, Lee makes it as if these are the Keystone Cops. They're not. You know, they're not.
No, I think you're in the interview you did with Amy Goodman, which we read in prep for this meeting, you know, you talked about three possible, whether or not there was a conspiracy, that there was the possibility of a unity of interest between
right.
the NYPD, between the Nation of Islam, and between even, unfortunately, members of his new Organization of African-American Unity
That's
and
right.
the Muslim Musk Incorporated, right?
That's right.
So one of the things that we said we didn't want to go into just because we wanted to go forward, but it continues to be so fascinating, I can't stop it, is go back to the story about why he chose to not have armed protection that night and any interpretation you can make of it. Ozzie Davis in an interview said that Malcolm went to see Ozzie and Ruby perhaps a couple of weeks before he died.
That's right.
And said, I maybe have a couple of weeks. I mean, he was aware of that. And given that, why do you think that he didn't have armed self-protection, as you said in the interview, with the emphasis on protecting the principal, protecting the president?
Well, I think that Malcolm was very conflicted in that last week. He was concerned about less about his own physical safety and more about the survival and the development of a movement that would go beyond him. And he thought of himself already as a dead man. So perhaps this was not the paramount issue that Malcolm had to consider, or at least the way he thought about it during that last terrible week. I have my own thoughts about this, which I'm still trying to work through the writing. And over the next year or so, I think I'll be a little bit more definitive than I can be today. But Malcolm not only ordered his men not to be armed that day, but that no one was checked at the door.
Right.
And the security was incredibly lax. We have, through our own research, I've discovered the NYPD's police investigation reports, investigative reports, of over 100 people at the Audubon who were interviewed over the following 6 weeks after the assassination. So I have a fairly good idea of what the police learned. And we also have the names of people, all of the roughly 19 men who were on guard duty that day and the rotations that they had. They changed off every 25 minutes. There are real questions that I have about his security force, what they did and what they did not do. I really don't want to speculate at this point more, but I can say that there are a series of questions that I have that I'm working through right now.
Well, it's funny. I want to maybe segue, Manning, into two issues. One is trying to get our listeners to understand the historical period they weren't in, and maybe talk to you also as a fellow book writer and agonizer. On the first, I think that it's very hard. I mean, I'm here with Damon, my close comrade and friend, and I was saying, Damon, say again, when were you born?
74.
Right, you were born in 74. And it's very hard for people to understand this period in history who weren't there. It almost feels impossible sometimes. I was in prison, for instance, for a year and a half for demonstrations against the war. I was in a collective where the police kicked in the door. We were charged with all kinds of things, some of which I won't go into, but luckily we were able to beat the charges. And in today's George Bush national security state, there's no way anybody's going to beat any charges, because they won't need you will not be exonerated by a judge who even believes in any kind of illegal search and seizure or any kind of technicalities like that. In looking at King's last year and listening to the speech about I may not get to the mountaintop with you, I may not get to the promised land, he's also a dead man walking in many ways. This is trying to explain that to people, that he feels his death. He feels the bullet almost about to go into his brain. So you wonder, under those circumstances, the absolute brilliance of these two men, both of whom understood that they were going to die at a very early age, and yet are trying to build a movement. So I think it's very, very hard for people that are, you know, very militant today, really good kids, if I can say, and very dedicated, but who have not understood the level of first police repression, but then, as you pointed out, that the person right next to you is a cop.
Right.
The brother or sister who you trust with your life, who you're talking to about the police, your own fears of death,
is a cop.
There is almost impossible for people to comprehend that. The American Indian movement in L.A. at one point had 12 people, six of whom were cops.
Mm.
You know, so, you know, let's just stay there a minute. Why don't you talk a little bit about that, and then I want to get to the second issue of your book and the dilemmas
right.
of one writer to another.
Well, you know, the FBI had massive surveillance on Malcolm that escalated dramatically after his break with the Nation of Islam. And they, for years, tried to exacerbate the tensions between Malcolm and Elijah Muhammad.
Hmm.
Now, one of the great tragedies of the book, The Autobiography of Malcolm X, is that in the fall of 1963, Malcolm and Haley collaborated on three chapters of the book that were in 64 or 65 deleted from the book. that are now in the possession of an attorney in Detroit, in his safe, Gregory Reed, who's an attorney in Detroit. He purchased these chapters for $100,000 at the Haley estate auction after Haley's death in 1992. And since then, hardly anybody's ever seen them. I think only a couple scholars, Clay Carson at Stanford, and myself, I think. Maybe a few other people. But Malcolm wanted, you know, if you read the book, what you see is there's no analysis. There's no economic analysis, and there's no program. What are you going to do in the ghetto? What is your program? What's your social program?
That's right.
And I always thought that that was missing from the book. And, yeah, he wrote it. It's just it was taken out. So, you know, there's so much excavation that is necessary. The same thing is true if you look at Malcolm and his relationship to the NYPD and some of the things we're discovering. I mean, the cops had wiretapped illegally. You know, forget about, you know, this is J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. Forget it. Well, you know, like today, you
right,
know,
that's right.
No court orders. You know, these are illegal wiretaps on literally hundreds and hundreds of phones. But what the OAAU brothers and sisters never realized is that the wiretap, when the phone was hung up, they could continue to wiretap that room from the phone so that they knew everything, you know, literally. And those things that they didn't pick up from the phone tap, they picked up because they had agents and informants within the organization. And usually they placed these people in the security personnel. Usually, well, that's where they place them.
That's right. And one of the things that's particularly upsetting to me is when people who did not go through the period said, well, the Panthers should have done this, and Malcolm should have done this, and Martin should have done this. And I don't think their human relations were as good as they could have been, you know. And I don't think people understand that you're literally fighting for your own sanity, that the fear of death, you know, that if you look at the soldiers in Iraq and besides all the horrible physical infirmities they come back to, the high level of mental illness, and yet going, you know, fighting for your freedom is one of the most dangerous and, as you point out, just absolutely threatening experiences, you know, that it's a miracle how well people were treated in the movement, in my opinion. It's a miracle how beautiful so many people were under this level of stress that I don't think most people can comprehend.
It's very terrible stress.
Right. So I'm going to segue now, writer to writer.
I want to, yeah, okay. Right before you segue.
You go.
Manning, you
Eric
said.
Eric and Mann and Damon Azali with Manning Marable. Go ahead, Dave.
You just get this little jewel of information about these three chapters. You said that there was kind of a tactical plan. And I know you got to look at it, even if it's briefly, and I just wondered in 2 minutes if you can say a little bit about what that plan was and if that was the same plan that was put in the program for the Organization of African American Unity.
It parallels it,
okay,
except that it has a critical difference, that what Malcolm was seeking was, and largely the thematics were around economic development. And community economic development.
Within the kind of empire, within the U.S.
Within the United States, of the African-American community, of what was necessary to build self-sufficiency and self-determination. A plan, a practical plan for self-determination for the black ghetto, okay, in the mid-60s. But what was significant about it was the political leverage of it. That is, Malcolm envisioned this being led by the Nation of Islam in conjunction with civil rights, members of civil rights organizations, fraternal groups, sororities, fraternities, civic associations, the Prince Hall Masons, other groups. So in the classic Marxist sense, it was a united front from below. That is, a unity of working people, poor people, and even middle stratum people who could unite around self-sufficiency and pride in the black community, electing officials, but also fighting against police brutality and injustice. So I strongly suspect that one of the key reasons that he was pressured out of the nation was because in the last year and a half of his life, really the turning point was the police atrocity against the Nation of Islam in Los Angeles in the spring of 1962, where Malcolm flies out to L.A.
Right.
And there for about 6 days or so, or a week, and he agitates, and he unites with CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, but Elijah Muhammad pulls the plug on the mobilization. And Malcolm is deeply embarrassed and ashamed that, you know, he leaped out here and did the right thing, and then he slapped down by Elijah. And so he starts going out on his own. And Mas 7 does anti-police brutality protests, demonstrations in Times Square on New Year's Day in 1963. Malcolm attends as an observer the March on Washington in August 1963, even though there's an expressed order by Elijah Muhammad not to attend the march. He goes anyway.
Hmm.
So all of this tells me that before the chickens come home to roost, talk or comment that ostensibly has Malcolm's silence, that has nothing to do with it. What the reason there is tension is because Malcolm is injecting a proactive, progressive line inside of this organization. And he's pushing them toward the idea of developing unity with broad masses of folk. And you hear that if you listen to, say, Message to the Grassroots. That's the line he's taking.
Yeah, well, let me try to do two things in 6 minutes. How's this? The first is, you've worked on this book for 10 years, is that correct?
Well, a long time.
A long time.
But, you know, I founded African American Studies at Columbia back when I was director for 10 years, so that I had to put a lot of that away. Now, some of the stuff I've written on Malcolm has been published in my new book, Living Black History.
Right, which we're going to get.
Okay.
And who published that, Matt?
That's Basic Books,
Great.
Basic Civitas.
Great. Well, one thing, I didn't mean it as a criticism. I mean, I'm working on just two things. I'm just finishing up tonight, if you can imagine, a book called Letter in Support of a Black Reconstruction in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast.
Oh, right.
And in the miracle of the Frontlines Press, which is our own press, we're going to print tomorrow morning, and we're still editing proofs.
Oh, wow.
At midnight.
I know the feeling.
So you know the feeling. So, no, I have many books that are long delayed. My question to you is there any element in how long this takes of you feeling the historical burden of realizing how important you are, frankly, and how every sentence will be poured over for maybe one of the greatest, not maybe, for one of the greatest figures in U.S. history? Is that a factor in how long it takes to make a book like this happen?
Right. You feel a very, and you know what I mean by this, Eric, you feel a great sense of responsibility, not just to get it right, but also to have nuance and subtlety in how you get it right.
Exactly.
And that you really want to have as full a possible view of things. I think that in constructing this book, there have been a number of surprises, things that I anticipated that didn't happen, and then avenues of information that I couldn't have dreamt of that have now opened up to me that will greatly shape the character of the book. I hate to be so
elusive and elliptical.
Yeah, but I just can't tell you right now, but what I could say is that I do have a reservoir of a lot of new information, and a lot of people who work with Malcolm, we've been able to do oral histories. And some of those things are online. You can, if you access my website, MalcolmXProject.net, www.MalcolmXProject.net. And our listeners can look at some of the interviews with people like James 67 X Shabazz, who was Malcolm's chief of staff, Max Stanford, Muhammad Ahmed, in the Revolutionary Action Movement. You can see Herman Ferguson in his interview. He was the best eyewitness to the assassination. So you can see clips of those, and a lot of the things that we've already done are available to people.
That's great, Manning. And then the last question is, who would have thought at the height of the civil rights movement that we would see a city of 500,000 people, 350,000 of whom were black, literally blown away with the full support of the United States government, and 7 months later,
yes,
for my estimate is 225,000 of those people are still dispersed.
That's right. It's unimaginable. We could not have imagined this, not in our wildest dreams.
And what would you say Malcolm and Manning's contribution to the discussion of New Orleans is, as you get the last word?
Malcolm would say that ultimately the deep irresponsibility and contempt of the U.S. government for human life and for humanity is clearly represented, perhaps best represented in our own time, by New Orleans. That no event since the assassination of Martin King in my own lifetime has been a moment that has made African Americans so angry in this country. To see the spectacle of bloated black bodies floating in the city and our government doing nothing. That it was just so outrageous in the extreme that even the world was shocked. And that this government has not even a fig leaf of justification for its inactions.
Well,
the actions that it took.
Oh, Manning, we're going to have to just leave it on Malcolm and come back for Manning for the next show.
I guess so.
But I want to thank you for being with us. We got to go to the next to the end of the show. We want to say that this is the end of Voices from the Front Lines. Your co-hosts, Damon Azzali and Eric Mann. Thanks for joining us. We have music from Gian Gilberto, Ice Cube, and Magla Peak is probably going to put on Run DMC anytime right now. If you want more information about our show, our comments, you can go to voices@thestrategycenter.org. We'd like to thank our producer, Alan Minsky, our production assistant, Lisa Adler, our incomparable engineer, Maggie LePeak, and we'll see you next week on Voices from the Front Lines. Up next is Susie Weissman with Beneath the Surface.
Take good care, Manning.
Perfect time to want to climb and I'm rhyming out.